Ehrenhardt case here, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case, is actually a different inquiry. That case said the reasonableness of the disbursements to be allowed the prevailing party depends not so much on the size of the plaintiff's claim as on the complexity of proving the claim or defending against it. The analysis is, what did it take for you to get from point A, the beginning of the case, to when you prevailed? What were those costs? The fact that you didn't get everything you wanted, the fact that you incurred costs, even that you, for example, for an expert who didn't testify or maybe was only a consulting expert, those costs can still be awarded because that's all those efforts together is what it took for you to win the case.
Can still be awarded or must still be awarded?
Your Honor, you're correct. It must be awarded. The language of the statute, Minnesota Statute 549.04, is that they shall be awarded. And the analysis is really...
Isn't there an overlay, though, between the cost and disbursement statute, the 549, and the expert witness statute of 357, where, you know, it's true, must be assigned, must be paid under one, but there seems to be an additional just and reasonableness overlay when it comes to expert testimony.
Your Honor, I agree that all of it goes to an analysis of what is reasonable, but the statute that controls the award of costs is 549.04.
Are you suggesting there's no application of 357 in this process?
I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor. It does play into it, but there's no difference in the reasonableness between in assessing reasonableness of costs in terms of 549.04 and 357.25. The question is, were the costs incurred reasonable? If they were not unreasonable in this, and we know what reasonableness is. That's not an unknown standard. Minnesota General Rule of Practice 127 says, gives an idea of what this should be. It says, expert costs shall be allowed in such amount as is deemed reasonable for such services in the community where the trial occurred, and in the field of endeavor where they are qualified as an expert. So the question is, did they charge a rate that's consistent with the marketplace? Did they do the work that's consistent of the type of expert who is doing the work?
And your view is then it doesn't matter, I gather, that your client recovered approximately 1/5 of 1% of what these experts were, your client's experts were arguing should have gone to your client as damages.
For purposes of what was reasonable to incur, no, Your Honor, it's not relevant to that analysis. Because again, capacity prevailed. And in the, I believe it's the Aegis case, the Ernster case, the court said the jury's rejection of what appears to have been appellant's unrealistic valuation of his damages didn't alter that party prevailed and was awarded their costs. So again, the analysis is, were the costs we incurred reasonable in the context of the complexity of the claims? And in fact, the district court applied that analysis to the university's costs. The abuse of discretion here is that it failed to do so for capacity's costs. For example, at appellant's addendum 8 and 9, that's where the district court applied an analysis of reasonableness to the university's costs. It said that, for example, Roger Entner, one of their experts, that the costs he incurred were reasonable because of the complexity of the claims he faced, the volume of information he reviewed, the fact that he had to put together an affidavit in response to a motion in limine made his costs necessary, and that his rate was reasonable. If the district court had applied this analysis to capacity, first of all, we submit that it would have found that capacity's costs were equally reasonable. And that's for a few reasons. The complexity of the claims that the court found, that the court evaluated in terms of awarding Mr. Entner his costs, were precisely the same complexity that capacity's experts faced. There were no counterclaims in this case. Capacity brought claims. The university defended against them. The complexity that the two sides had to face was equivalent. The volume of information, if anything, was equivalent or greater for capacity. The university's experts offered only rebuttal reports. Capacity's expert, and in doing so, they reviewed the work of capacity's experts. Capacity's experts, of course, had to review documents and put things together. And indeed, at trial, Mr. Entner testified he had reviewed only 13 documents out of thousands produced in the case. So to the extent that the analysis of who put out a reasonable effort is complexity of claims or volume of information reviewed, certainly that was equivalent between the parties. And then as to the necessity of the experts' work, the district court, and we've written about this extensively in the briefs, but the district court denied, in part, the university's motion for summary judgment expressly relying on capacities expert reports. And we know that that was necessary. We know the expert reports are necessary because this is what the court...
It's necessary to get over summary judgment. I'm just thinking of a hypothetical case where experts just articulate something to get past summary judgment, even if it's clear that no reasonable jury would adopt, no fact finder would accept the propositions, but it's enough to get past summary judgment. I'm not convinced, maybe you can press the point, why it is that summary judgment as opposed to the trial is the moment that we should be looking to for reasonableness, and if you could, provide a case to support your theory.
Yes, Your Honor. A few points. The fact that the court relied on the experts' summary judgment is not the only reason that our costs are reasonable, but it is evidence in support of the fact that it was, and this is why. The court wrote in its summary judgment order, this is at docket 57 at page 8, if capacity is unable to demonstrate damages, then summary judgment is appropriate, and we plaintiff is required to provide proof of a reasonable basis upon which damages can be estimated. So capacity couldn't just have gotten past summary judgment simply by creating some kind of a fact issue. And in fact, the court found capacity has produced reports of multiple experts to establish its expectancy damages.
Right, which ultimately the fact finder rejected. So I get that's my point. Let's assume, I mean, it's easy to get past summary judgment if you just have an expert opine to a certain theory, even if the district court, the district court's not supposed to weigh the evidence, not supposed to weigh credibility at summary judgment. So the district court looks at the affidavits of the experts, the expert report, and says, it doesn't seem logical to me, but I don't know how a jury's going to adopt this, but I'll be reversed if I grant it summary judgment. I'm not convinced that the ability to create a fact issue by making an assertion of fact is sufficient to establish the reasonableness of the expert's services before or after summary judgment.
Your Honor, what I would submit is that it doesn't make the expert's work unreasonable. I would also respectfully disagree that the jury rejected our expert's testimony. They did award damages, although it was a lesser amount than we asked for. I would point the court to the McGrath...
To say that it's a lesser amount, I mean, you're asking... I mean, 99.92% of your client's claim for damages was rejected by the jury.
Yes, Your Honor, but again, the difference in scope between what was sought and what was actually awarded doesn't impact the prevailing party analysis, and also, I submit, does not affect the reasonableness of what it took to get from the beginning of the case through to summary judgment. I would point the case, the court, to the McGrath case. In that case, the district court rejected a damages expert's opinion, but still awarded the costs for that expert to provide testimony or to submit an expert report, even despite rejecting that theory. And that is because, again, what you look at is how complex was the case? What did it take to get to the point where you prevailed? Once it's determined that a party has prevailed, the analysis is, were the costs it took to get there unreasonable? And here, the district court abused its discretion by never determining that capacity's cost, the work that its experts performed, was unreasonable. The district court did not evaluate didn't say anything about the rates that the experts were paid, the volume of information that they did. The court ignored that it had itself relied on and noted that it was critical to have a viable theory of damages with proof, the expert reports. And the court just didn't do any of that analysis. So at a minimum, the court abused its discretion by failing to use the same analysis to evaluate the university's costs as capacity.
When you say, just to be clear, you've got Rule 68 on the one hand and you've got 549 on the other. And Rule 68 allows for the discretion in the district court only to reduce the amount of damages. If it's an undue hardship on the party, as opposed to 549, which places the discretion of the district court not at the possibility of reduction, but at the beginning, that whether you assign fees at all, the costs at all has to be reasonable and just. at the outset. Can you discuss the, do you see any difference of in application as to how the district court should it, should deal with Rule 68 versus 549 costs?
Yes, Your Honor. The court, of course, has discretion to reduce costs that are merely necessary, that are merely convenient rather than necessary, and to reduce a cost when there would create an inequity to award it. The court did not analyze if there would be any inequity here in awarding capacity, again, the prevailing party, the costs it incurred. And the court did no analysis of what was only convenient versus necessary. And I would submit it was necessary. We could not have gotten past summary judgment, at least in the view of the court, if we hadn't demonstrated proof of a viable theory of damages. That is what the court said in its summary judgment order. So absent that proof, we couldn't have gotten past summary judgment, and the district court likely would have dismissed our claims. So the court had discretion to reduce, per Rule 68, it did have discretion to reduce the award.
But it wasn't required to.
It wasn't required to, and certainly not as to capacity, because again, capacity prevailed. There was no inequity in awarding capacity the cost
incurred. Rule 68.
Yes, Your Honor. Per Rule 68, you can reduce costs to, that's part of the rules, you can reduce costs to avoid inequities. There was no inequity here, certainly none identified by, the university didn't argue that there would be such inequity. And the district court didn't analyze, and I would again submit, all of capacity's expert costs that it incurred were necessary. They were not merely convenient. By comparison, as we submitted, we believe that the university's costs that it was awarded for its experts to prepare, for spend a lot of time preparing for trial, some of that may have been convenient, but it was not necessary. When the university's experts were only offering rebuttal opinions, they spent a great deal of time both preparing for trial and sitting in trial.
How do we know? How can we assess what's necessary without getting into the jury's mind as to why they adopted the defendant's theory and rejected your client's?
Your Honor, I don't believe we need to get into the jury's mind at all. We can look at what was necessary. It's, of course, necessary for an expert to prepare for trial. That everyone agrees with that. The amount of time that takes differs for every case based on the complexity of the case. I would submit that the amount of time that was taken here was convenient rather than necessary. But certainly what we do know for capacity's costs is that they were necessary. We, not to belabor the point as to summary judgment, but the district court likely would have dismissed our claims. In fact, it appears to have said so, absent proof from our experts. And we then, the experts testified at trial, and capacity did prevail. The jury found the university liable and awarded damages to capacity. So for those reasons, it's our view, we believe that this court, that the district court abused its discretion, that this court should reverse and remand and order the court, the district court, to enter an award for capacity's costs and disbursements that it reasonably incurred in prevailing in this case. And I have 8 seconds left. I'd be happy to take any question in that time.
Doesn't appear as if any of the panel members have questions, but you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Peter Magnuson on behalf of the respondent, University Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota. The district court had discretion to award expert fees and reduce expert fees to ensure that any such award was just and reasonable in light of Section 357.25. And the district court here exercised that discretion appropriately to address what was really significant overreach in a damages theory by capacity. And this morning, I'm just gonna focus, at least I plan to focus on the expert fee issue only. Of course, I'm happy to answer any questions on the costs and do that. But I'll start with the expert fees.
Do that. Mr. Magnuson, what is unjust? In other words, we're all used to the reasonableness concept, but as to the experts, which was the significant part, 357, what part of the specific part of the judge's analysis do you point to that, okay, that's the just, with the just and reasonable, the part that obviously the judge must have found unreasonable, and is that supported by case law as a basis for denial?
Thank you. I was going right there, oh. Your Honor, with what I think here is one of the most important things to clear up is the statutory framework itself. Counsel focused an awful lot on what was reasonable to incur on the front end. And we acknowledge that under Section 549.04, that's an important question, what was reasonable to incur on the front end. But 357.25, I think as Your Honor, Judge Ross put it, is an overlay. And it requires the cost, the expert witness fees, to be just and reasonable to award, not just and reasonable to incur. It wouldn't make any sense to say what would be just to incur. Just and reasonable, even on the text of the statute itself, it says the judge of any court of record before whom any witness is summoned or sworn and examined as an expert in any profession or calling may allow such fees or compensation as may be just and reasonable. It's talking about the award must be just and reasonable. And that's exactly what the district court did here when it was assessing capacity's expert witness fees. It wasn't addressing, first and foremost, whether they were reasonable to incur. It was doing what the statute told it to do, which was to address whether it would be just and reasonable to award those fees. And to get to your question specifically, the judge found that it would be unjust to award the fees given capacity's overreach in the damages theory. The other thing I just want to point out, Your Honor, is that this was not a case, as counsel suggests, where it was just a lesser amount that was given. This was a case where the jury rejected the category of damages that the experts were intending to support and testified to at trial, and instead accepted an entirely different category of damages that those experts did not testify to.
Can I pause you just for a moment?
Yes.
What's the most persuasive authority for the distinction you make between the reasonable to incur and reasonable to award distinction?
I would point out a couple things. One, the plain text of the statute, I think, could not be read to say just to incur. But beyond that, even the cases that capacity cites applies the Section 357.25 as an overlay as to what would be just and reasonable in terms of expert fees to award. And this is exactly what the district court—
But just to be clear, you're asking us to draw an inference from the way those cases analyzed the challenge. But you weren't able to identify, I don't want to put words in your mouth, correct me if I'm wrong, you aren't able to identify any authority that specifically addresses this distinction and calls attention to the distinction.
I would point the court to the Stinson case, to the Quaid case, to the Aegis case, which capacity cites a great deal, for the application of this specific statute to the award of an expert
fees. I understand the application, but as far as discussing the language that you're asking us to...
I do not have a case, Your Honor, here today in which someone has made that exact distinction, but I do believe that's the fair implication from the text itself. Does that address that question?
Thank you. If I took you off track from Judge Slater's question, please.
No, but I think when you get to that distinction, right, it's helpful to understand what the district court found and the circumstances of the case. And not to belabor the facts here, but just very briefly, the university and capacity intended to be business partners to try to increase wireless service on campus at the University of Minnesota. And they entered a memorandum of understanding, similar to a letter of intent, by which capacity would be the sole point of contact between the university and between wireless carriers. The jury found that the university breached that memorandum of understanding. And it was undisputed at trial that the only amount the university gained in gross profit from that negotiation with carriers was $52,300. The district court said no expert was needed to support that breach, and there was no expert that was needed to identify the gross profits that the university gleaned from that. That was what the university awarded. None of capacity's experts testified to that amount, $52,300. Capacity made the strategic choice to try to inflate, give a new category of damages, $28 million to $42 million, and hired experts to try to support that theory. And the jury rejected it completely. They awarded a category of damages that their experts did not intend to testify to and did not need to testify to support. So the district court found that under those circumstances, it would not be just to award fees for damages claims, a damages theory that capacities experts testified to and the jury entirely rejected. One way to think of it, Your Honor, capacity was free to make a strategic choice to effectively bet $160,000 in expert fees that it could receive $28 to $42 million at trial. It was free to do that. But the district court also could properly find in its discretion that it wasn't just to shift the risk of that bet to the university under Section 357.25 and effectively say to the university, you have to bear all the risk of what capacity is doing, hiring experts to try to receive a $28 to $42 million damages award that the jury rejected. So I...
Part of the point, as I understand it, appellate making, there seems to be a distinct way the judge looked at your client's expert witness fees and other costs versus theirs. And it seems to me the argument you're making today somewhat is different from what we're used to seeing, and as we don't necessarily look at what the jury ultimately, because it's a battle of experts and juries will decide what they're going to decide, but would it be a fair than using your distinction between just and reasonable to say that the court looked at a more traditional reasonableness to award in your case, but used the just only in the case of the appellant?
I think that stems simply from a garden variety application of Rule 68, Your Honor. The Althaus case talks about the dual adverse consequences, the mandatory nature of Rule 68. The university was forced to hire experts precisely because capacity tried to extend this into a straightforward $52,300 damages claim into a $28 to $42 million damages claim. That's exactly why the university needed to hire those experts and incur the costs and expert witness fees that it did at trial. So this was simply an extension of Rule 68's command that there is to be a powerful incentive, as Althaus puts it, towards settlement. And to the extent that the district court seemed to be more lenient in reflection of the university's expert witness fees, it was directly flowing from what the university was forced to do to respond to and prepare for a $28 to $42 million claim at trial.
Can you discuss the interplay between, or the difference of approach to your client's Rule 68 basis for costs and including witness fees, expert witness fees, and 549 or 357?
Yes. The district court found that it would not be just to award fees based on this overreach. It was addressing what it saw to be capacity's overreach at trial.
I'm talking about just the legal structure is what I'm asking you to touch on, as far as how should the court, district court, and how should this court consider the different procedural mechanisms that are in play as to your client's claim for costs and the appellant's claim for costs?
Rule 68 is, as we've discussed, mandatory, and it reflects that a district court must award the costs and disbursements. We would agree that Section 357.25 would require still that those be just and reasonable costs. And in this case, the district court was well within its discretion to find that it would be reasonable to award those costs, given that the university was forced to prepare for a two-week trial in which $28 to $42 million was on the line. And under those circumstances, it was reasonable for the university to use the experts in the way that it did because it had to rebut a claim. Now, when the jury rejected that claim, the entire category of damages altogether, it would not be just and reasonable to shift those fees to the university, but it was still nonetheless reasonable for the university to incur them when it was facing this claim at trial.
Have you found any case to support your, lack of a better term, your wager metaphor?
No, not directly, Your Honor, other than that I would say there is, again, The question here is about the discretion that the district court had. And the only thing that I would point Your Honor to are the cases like the Carlson case, in which courts reduced the amount that an expert was entitled to. In fact, capacity concedes that the district court had the discretion to reduce its expert witness fees. It does that on page 28 of its opening brief. Capacity's only complaint seems to be that the district court reduced the award to zero. We don't think that's any difference in kind, Your Honor, particularly here under the amount of overreach that is there. It is undisputed that there was discretion to reduce the award. Was there discretion to reduce the award to zero? Under really the unique circumstances of the overreach here, we think that the district court was entirely within its discretion to do that. In light of that straightforward, we think, logic, Your Honor, of the application of 549.04 with the overlay of section 357.25 and the district court's discretion here, sitting through a two-week trial, seeing all the witness testimony, all the expert witness testimony, assessing the credibility of each of the witnesses, we think that it was entirely within the discretion of the district court not only to reduce the award of capacity's expert fees to zero, but also to give and grant award the university its entire expert fees. Actually, not even all of its expert fees was that which was granted. The district court did reduce the university's expert fees as it felt was reasonable and appropriate. But in light of its discretion and the straightforward exercise of that discretion, we would ask that the district court's cost order be affirmed.
Do you see the issue of the interplay between the statutes or any other issue in this case to be a matter of first impression for this court?
I don't believe so on the plain text of the statute, though I cannot cite a case to you in which the district court reduced an expert fees award to zero.
Assuming it's a case of first impression, we decided to publish. What is the university's position as to what the rule of law is that we should establish and guide our decision?
The rule of law that we would see, Your Honor, was that the district court has discretion under Section 357.25 to reduce an award of expert fees, including to zero, on the unique circumstances of this kind of overreach and whether it would be just and reasonable to award the fees to capacity in light of that overreach. Unless you have any further questions, I'll yield my remaining time.
Doesn't appear as if any panel member has another question. Thank you. And I should have mentioned this to both counsel before we started, since this is the first time we're all back. We have three microphones set up in case there was any concern about social distancing. And so you've both opted for the middle microphone. It's too late now. You shared all the air. So I guess I'm looking in retrospect and saying good luck with your health.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'm confident in Mr. Magnuson's health. He seems like he's doing well.
Mr. Penilovich, before you get started,
could I ask
a question about standard of review? Your brief identifies two, abuse of discretion and de novo for legal issues. Which, if any, of your arguments raise questions of law that are subject to de novo standard of review?
Your Honor, the abuse of discretion standard, of course, applies to the review of the district court's order. As Judge Ross just noted, to the extent that there is a matter of first impression here, that would likely be subject to de novo review. But at this point, we believe that the issues presented to the court are abuse of discretion. And turning to Your Honor's question just a moment ago about if this is a matter of first impression, this is an issue that's been well established in Minnesota law. The problem here is how the law was applied. In the three cases that Mr. Magnuson referred to, Stinson, Aegis, and I believe it was Quaid, the district court awarded fees to the costs and disbursements to the prevailing party. And in fact, in none of the cases cited across any of the briefs, does the district court reduce to zero, or even, in fact, reduce costs and disbursements assigned to a for an expert for the prevailing party. And I would submit that it would be counter to public policy to create a rule of law that allows the district court to reduce to zero a prevailing party's expert costs, because that would chill litigation. There are circumstances. Many of the cases we've cited are insurance coverage disputes where there are assignments of liability. And it is the case that sometimes a prevailing party achieves less than it sought, and that is sometimes due to offsets or for other reasons. And in fact, the Ernster case says specifically, I quoted it earlier, but it says that, I had it in front of me, the jury's rejection of what appears to have been an unrealistic valuation doesn't alter that they prevailed. If the court were to change the law, that could also alter what a party is, whether they've prevailed. And it may cause a party to say, hey, maybe I'm not going to bring a lawsuit that I find meritorious because maybe I won't get the costs I incur even if I win. And I think that this goes to another point that, Your Honor,
you're going to the point. I mean, if you know, client in your shoes, it's like, well, if we have a meritorious claim for over $28 million, how would a decision against your client chill a party in your client's shoes?
It seems like a
reasonable, it's like, well, you know, $100,000 in costs, why not roll the dice if it's a meritorious claim?
Well, this to your point, to Your Honor's point earlier about the wager metaphor, because our claim was meritorious. The jury found in our favor. The university breached a contract. It breached the implied covenant.
I mean, a theory, not a claim, but a certain theory that's being promoted within the bundle of claims one might raise.
I think it would require a litigant to know in advance what would be in the mind of a jury at the end of a case. Juries come out with decisions that sometimes reflect the arguments and the evidence, and sometimes they don't. But here, and I will say that I took exception as I read this wager metaphor throughout. Capacity didn't wager. The wager was that we would enter into a business agreement with a reliable business partner, and that didn't happen. The university was found liable on two counts. They violated our agreement. That was our wager, was entering into a business arrangement. Our lawsuit was to remedy our failed wager of entering into a business arrangement. We didn't wager on a great damages claim. That's what our experts told us it was worth. The jury didn't agree with all aspects of that, but that wasn't a bet. It was an attempt to remedy a wrong. And the jury said, you were wronged. They agreed with us. They didn't agree with exactly how we perceived the wrong or the scope of the wrong, but they did say that.
Can you address Mr. Magnus's argument that the university's argument that the university essentially didn't just disagree with some of the damages or theory of damages, but disagreed with an entire category of claims, and the argument that the expert witnesses weren't necessary and did not testify in support of the $52,000 your client did prevail in?
Sure, Your Honor. First of all, we had two experts that testified, one of them that went far more to liability in terms of the type of industry we were working in, the technology. So this idea that the experts only testified about damages is incorrect. Second, the verdict form didn't break out what expert did you believe in on what theory. It was breach of contract, implied covenant breach, award of damages. The jury was not polled. That type of analysis didn't occur. So I would submit that the district, in particular the abuse of discretion, is that the district court failed to apply the same standard of reasonableness to capacity as it did to the university. It didn't assess whether the costs incurred were reasonable within the context of the complexity of the claim and the volume. And I see my time is up, and so I will close by saying we ask this court to reverse and remand.
Well, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Kudilovich and Mr. Magnuson. Thank you for your briefing and for your oral argument today. The matter is well briefed and well argued. Your clients should both be very satisfied with the effort and the quality of your briefing. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And have a nice day.